And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. And we're streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Scroll down the main page, click on that red oval atop the little transmission tower there. That way you'll get the streaming link. So when you're the next time you run over to your desktop or mobile device or tell your friends how to do it, you'll know to click on the red oval so you can hear us on your little computer there. This is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, April 28, 2014. Now 3:02. And if those facts and figures jive with your own personal time-space continuum, then you know the show is live at 3:02 p.m. Pacific Time, May 28th, Monday. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil. And you caught me in the middle of doing a bunch of stuff. It is my hope. Whoops. No, we don't want that.
To This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org.
This is not supposed to be happening.
www.imemc.org for April 19th to the 20th. This week, Palestinian leaders reached a unity deal ending the 7 years division between the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Meanwhile, Israeli attacks targeting the Palestinian territories this week left at least a dozen injured civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the nonviolent activities organized in the West Bank.
This is David on Friday, one journalist was injured
and many other civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli troops attacked the two settlement protests organized at a number of West Bank villages. IMEMC's Majd Badjali has more.
On Friday, protests were organized at the villages of Bil'in,
All right, you should be able to hear me once again. This is the Mideast Migraine Show, and one form or another, I am simply trying to move some stuff around here. Okay, that's better. Scaring the bejiggers out of myself now. And that's really funny. If it weren't so sickening. We are going to have a program. Just as soon as I find out what my interviewee contact is doing here. Planned on having a live interview to, of all places, Morocco. Morocco, the country in North Africa. Of course, basically everything, culturally and linguistically speaking. Hello, David. No, the call failed. Everything north of the Sahara Desert in Africa, linguistically and culturally speaking, is Arabic and overwhelmingly Islamic. And this gentleman who I've made acquaintance with recently is actually from Canada. But he has chosen in his retirement to live in Morocco. In fact, I'll show you what he says here on his Skype profile. He's male, spoken language English. Personal information, as soon as possible. This is my contact speaking here. As soon as possible, after my 65th birthday, I moved from Canada to Morocco. 5 years later, I know it was a good decision. And I do not even know if he is indeed a Muslim. A Muslim, of course, is an adherent to the Islamic faith. The gentleman is offline. And if there were a reasonable way to restore, refresh this page, I'd do it. I'm assuming it has the most basic information. You know, I put many ads out to personal friends, lists I'm a member of, including the local Santa Cruz County/City Progressives email lists, declaring that I was going to have this interview with Mr. Vickery. He texted me on the Skype text program that he's... Well, this is really weird. I see messages and then they disappear. No, I just think they disappeared. Short excerpt from a text conversation I just had with Mr. Vickery a few minutes ago. Ren, I have a problem with my microphone. You'll have to play music until I get it fixed. Or in this case, I'm just going to talk at you instead of playing music. Yeah, I know which one you prefer. I texted him back, be sure all your volume levels or pots are turned up, because especially not being there, I don't know what his technical problem is. Well, he's still offline, folks. This time the problems appear to be with on Vickery's end of the line. So while he clears up his microphone problems and comes back to me again, let's take a look at what I have in store for you. I am your friendly global neighborhood Palestinian American coming to you from Santa Cruz County, California. And in this Mideast Migraine show, I endeavor to give you my take on Israel and Palestine issues. In ways that I think will genuinely bring about peace and justice. I'm groping for words here because I'm waiting for things to catch up with me here so I can view them on this, on my little TV screen. How's this for starters? A message from none other than Jewish Voice for Peace. Jewish Voice for Peace, an American-based, in fact, I believe it's a Berkeley, California-based online institution promoting genuine, workable peace and justice in the Holy Land. Student Victory, Northeastern University, reinstates students for justice in Palestine. Whoopee. This was sent to me just this morning. It says, Dear N, wow. When pro-Palestine students and their allies fight back, they win. After 7 weeks of protests, petitions, and news coverage, Northeastern University finally lifted the discriminatory suspension on Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP, and reinstated them as a student group. I'll just read the rest of this dispatch, and I'll fill in things that I think you need to know after I'm done with the dispatch. Let's send a strong message that a safe campus for SJP is a safe campus for all students. They want me to thank President Joseph Aoun and Robert Dean Jose for doing the right thing. When Jewish Voice for Peace activists in Boston, Massachusetts, first heard about SJP's suspension, we weren't sure how these students' voices could counter those of powerful right-wing organizations like the Zionist Organization of America. But SJP refused to be intimidated, immediately releasing a petition and call for solidarity. Activists like you responded to that call. On the ground, JVP Boston, that's Jewish Voice for Peace Boston, organized a coalition of 30 community and student groups who brought over 200 protesters to Northeastern's campus. Nationally, over 100 JVP activists called and emailed President Aoun to oppose the suspension. Now, Aoun Jose may face a backlash from the same right-wing groups that pushed for SJP's suspension. Let's act now to thank and encourage administrators to stand for justice and free speech. In solidarity, Eliza Berendt, JVP Boston organizer. Okay, so this particular Northeastern University apparently is in Boston, or like Harvard and other major schools out there, perhaps just outside the city limits of Boston. They are talking, of course, about one of several instances in which, whether you're talking about Students for Justice in Palestine or Coalition for Justice in Palestine, there are a number of them, mainly SJPs, in campuses across the country, are assailed, attacked, threatened with this or that by supporters of Israel, supporters of the Zionist State of Israel. The usual complaint being that the message of SJP and others who are in solidarity with the Palestinians, as they would say, quote unquote, tends to foment anti-Semitism, tends to... Okay, folks, I apologize again. I know you can hear me, but I need to deal with circumstances in the studio. I'm going to play some more music here for the time being. Please. Just getting things lined up here, trying to make order in the studio. Thank you. Okay, folks. I apologize again. I had to step away from the microphone so I can politely ask people who are making noises just outside this studio, which is not a commercially viable studio in terms of soundproofing. I had to politely ask them to keep it down. Okay. And I'm already frustrated because of the technical problems. This is the second time I've tried to have this interview with Mr. Victory. I don't know what's going on with on his end of Skype or on my end or with Skype as a problem here. We just have to hang in and bear with. Aha. Now, I finished reading to you the exact text of that dispatch from JVP. I'm going to step away from that again. I see that Mr. Vickery is online. He is online. Good old Skype program there. David, can you hear me?
I can hear you, but can you hear me?
I can only hear you way, way in the background, and I can barely make out your words. Can you hear me clearly? That's the problem, he writes me. Can you text me anything about the particulars of your microphone problem? Because I can't hear anything now.
I have no idea what the problem is. Really, I have no idea.
I saw you writing something, and then it looked as though you scratched it out. Oh, here you go again. Okay, you're writing again. David says, I have no idea what the problem might be. How did you know you had a microphone problem to begin with? Text me back. I tested it, David says. David, I'm sure because I asked you to call me about 20 minutes or 50 minutes before the hour, I'm sure that you have been sweating like a horse trying to make this work, so I don't want to push it. And you're texting me again. Yeah, busily trying to fix the problem. That's exactly what I'm saying. Well, David, keep in mind, as I'm talking to you, I'm also on the air, and I'm talking to my radio program. David says, what can we do? As I said earlier, if I'm not there with you dealing with the microphone program, there's not much that I can do. This is especially, well, it's frustrating for both David, who is my contact in Morocco, and me, because this is the second attempt we've made to do this interview using the Skype program. Skype is an internet program used for people to talk vocally and to text auxiliarily, computer to computer. It's talking through your computers like they used to do on the Jetsons and at various exhibitions in Disneyland and the World's Fairs and things like that. This Skype program is not cooperating with us today either. I feel like a dog because, as I said, this is the second time that I promised people I was going to do this. I'd hate to have to let people down for the second time in a row. It doesn't make me look very good as a radio programmer. It doesn't make free radio look very good. David, if you can hear me, I'd like you to keep plugging away. I know it's, what is it, 11:22 your time at night, and I'm sure you just assume would rather be in bed. All I can say is please continue. Not really what? You don't... Not tired. Okay, that's encouraging. Then all I can say is keep trying. Did you... you are talking to Freak Radio to our Skype address, freak.radio1013. Is that correct? Good. Yes. I've got my basic volume level turned up. I've got the telephone line turned up. Here, let me turn up line 2, see if that helps. Say something, David.
I'm talking now.
I heard you cursing.
No, that wasn't cursing. Not cursing.
Well, you're coming in a little tiny, little bit better. I'm hoping that the more we keep plugging away at this, what I'm getting, David, is a hum, an intermittent hum. It's like, and your voice is, there's some evidence that your voice is coming a little clearer. I almost feel like Peter Pan now, begging the Tinkerbell to come out of her little hive here. Come on, baby, you can do it. Give me another sound check, David.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello. Can you hear anything?
I'm getting a fairly consistent hum. No voice still. My radio friends, please keep in mind, this is, we're talking about a gentleman who has to put up with possible shortfalls in his newly acquired homeland of Morocco here, technical shortfalls. Okay, David texts me. He says, okay, I'll be back as soon as possible. Okay, and he just hung up. So this interview will continue to be not happening for the moment. I am not giving up. This day, problem appears to be on his end, across the seas, not on my end, so you cannot blame me entirely. Just the fact that all this is being recorded is wreaking havoc in my brain. I got a pop-up here from Skype. How would you rate the overall quality of this call? Out of 5 stars, 1. Very bad. Problem so bad, the call was impossible. Call did connect, but I did not hear the other side. He appeared to be able to hear me. Speech was not natural and had distortions. There were cutoffs and fade-outs. I heard noise in the call. And I'm sending that feedback. Okay, offline again. David, who declared his enthusiastic attention to remain untired and to do the interview, still chose to end the call, apparently so he could deal with things on a technical level from his end of it. So, I'm hoping to hear from him again before the end of the show, which officially goes to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is, we're just 5 minutes short of a full 2 hours, this Mideast Madness program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Mideast migraines, particularly when it's working, and you can all hear me, and everything that's worth hearing from me, comes to you every Monday at 1500 hours. That's 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific time every Monday. And, of course, there is the Saturday edition every Saturday at 11 o'clock a.m., 1100 hours Pacific Daylight Time. Free radio broadcasts to the environs of the city of Santa Cruz, California on 101.3 FM. And this being a live show, in addition to all the previously recorded shows, comes to you via our online radio service at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval on the main page of our website so you can pick up the free streaming link. I'm endeavoring to hold it together. Okay, I was talking about the plight of Students for Justice in Palestine. Many outlets across the country on campuses all over. And they are often attacked, perhaps not physically, but people are pulling out all the stops. Zionist people who are in support of Israel, whether or not they think that they really should be in support of Israel, Israelis, AIPAC, Jewish Israeli spies, they do what they can to upset the activities of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the U.S. And the favorite thing that they do, or end up doing, is trying to get the administrations of the college and university campuses that host JVP and CJP, that host SJP and CJP franchises, to pull permission for those outfits to operate on campus, on campuses in this country. Hence, academic freedom is under attack. Rights of free speech are under attack because of this stubborn insistence that anyone who is critical of the state of Israel, anyone who is critical of the policies of Israel, its government, its military, the U.S. Congress in terms of how it deals or how the administration deals with its counterparts of Israel, anyone who's critical of any of those things must, in their eyes, be anti-Semites. That their primary motivation, according to the Israeli supporting people, is their hatred of Jews. Now, they do this all the time. I am always cautious when I jump to using absolute statements like they always do this or this happens all the time, but they certainly have a consistent track record of trying to repress groups like Students for Justice in Palestine by accusing them of racism, of anti-Semitism, when that is not what is going on at all. So that's the background story of this instance at Northeastern University in Massachusetts, where, call it pressure if you like or counter pressure, it's there's no question, this is a matter of fighting fire. But when you have people particularly deviously in the background trying to pressure those in positions of power on these campuses to shut down people simply because they criticize Israeli policy and U.S. government policy as it pertains to Israel, the pro-SJ people have fought back, which is exactly as she, Berendt says here, when pro-Palestine students and their allies fight back, they win. After 7 weeks of protests, petitions, and news coverage, that's critical, finally getting it out into the mainstream media, Northeastern University finally lifted the discriminatory suspension on Students for Justice in Palestine and reinstated them as a student group. It's just the old It's just censorship, folks, on a massive scale, on a very high-end scale. Just shut the people up, and we can all pretend that everything is hunky-dory in the Holy Land, and that supposedly there is complete peace and justice, there is complete political parity on the part of both non-Jew and Jew, which is very false. That's not what is going on in Israel, certainly not in the Israeli-occupied territories. So they're asking me to send a strong message to these administrators who have reversed themselves, thank goodness, the message that a safe campus for SJP is a safe campus for all students. So go to your favorite SJP website, just JewishVoiceForPeace.org, or perhaps www.jvp.org. to send a message to those administrators at Northwestern University to thank them for being brave and not getting pushed around, not allowing themselves to be bullied. Next item. New profile message. Samara Esmer. A guide for the perplexed on the return of the refugees. / MERIP.org. Who is that? Forwarded to me by my friend Daryl. A human history that no law can erase, says Daryl. Kafir Birim is a Palestinian Arab village in the Upper Galilee that was occupied by the Haganah militia in 1948. The villagers, Arabs, were expelled, but the Haganah promised them they could return within 2 weeks. The return never occurred, and the new state of Israel destroyed almost all of the village a few years later. But because of that original promise of return, the villagers did not think of themselves as completely like other Palestinian refugees, displaced for, or at least until, a comprehensive and just peace emerges. They filed appeal after appeal and continued to visit the two structures left standing on the village site. Now, like another set of displaced Palestinians from the village of Ikrit, the inhabitants of Kafir Birim have begun to simply go back to their home and stay there, holding events and hosting guests. They have, in effect, unilaterally declared their own return and created a new category of Palestinian, namely the, quote, no longer a refugee. What does this mean? Samara Esmer offers a guide for the perplexed on the return of the refugees, now in Middle East Report Online. Middle East Report Online is a free service of the Middle East Research and Information Project. In other words, MERIP, MERIP. Middle East Research and Information Project. I'm waiting for the link to go through here. And, okay, let's try this other one. I'm presuming there's an article this leads to. Aha! MERIP, Middle East Research and Information Project, published April 2014. Why, that's this month. A Guide for the Perplexed on the Return of the Refugees by Samara Esmer. Arrival. You have reached the village of Kafir Birim. Drive through the gate next to the sign designating the village as a national park, quote-unquote, national park. Ignore the information on the sign that only briefly mentions the existence of a Palestinian village here prior to 1948 while elaborating on other histories of the place. This strange historical method should come as no surprise given that the Israel Nature and Natural Parks Protection Authority put up the sign. A guard is positioned next to the gate to collect fees on behalf of said authority. To avoid the fee, drive with the confidence characteristic of the Arabs characteristic of the village's Arab Palestinian inhabitants. After their expulsion from the village and its transformation to a national park, they are allowed to visit their home without paying a fee. They were allowed to visit their home. I'll read that again just to keep my head together here. After their expulsion from the village and its transformation to a national park, the village's former Arab-Palestinian inhabitants were allowed to visit their home without paying a fee. If you can mimic their unmistakable sense of belonging and rootedness, only intensified after their expulsion, you should get a free pass. Park your car in the lot overlooking the cemetery, the only place where the inhabitants of the village do not risk expulsion, provided they are dead. Take a short hike up the hill on the stone steps, surrounded by lush trees. Pass a temple to your right. Keep going up and arrive at a small square. You have reached the center of the village. Stand there for a few seconds. Close your eyes and take a long, deep breath. Enjoy the clean air in the Upper Galilee. Listen to the mountain silence. Observe the elegance of the stone construction in front of you. It is left standing after the 1948 occupation of the village and its consequent destruction. Okay, I see that David is online again. I shall call him. I am calling Mr. David James Vickery. I'm getting the typical James, typical Skype beep, which is there. And, okay, call to David James Vickery busy, probably because he was trying to call me. I shall let him. Call me once more. Call me, David, if you're listening. Go ahead and call me at freak.radio 1013. Freak.radio 1013. That is Freak Radio's Skype identity. For your future reference, listeners. Okay. Back to the article. From the Middle East Research and Information Project. Isn't this a fun episode of Mideast Migraines, folks? Aren't you just having the greatest time? God, I hope so. I'm going to grab some water here. Okay, that helps. I read to you the beginning of the article. Subheading was Arrival. New subheading, The Square. And remember, folks, this article is talking about Palestinians who do not consider themselves refugees any longer. They are retaking possession of their native ancestral village. Subheading, The Square. Two renovated structures surround the square. To the left, the village church, and to the right, a two-room building, which until 1948 functioned as an elementary school. Climb to the roof of the school and absorb the vista-like views of the surrounding green hills stretching into Lebanon. Let your eyesight defy the restrictions that the occupation of Palestine in 1948 imposed on the Palestinians of the Galilee, who were no longer able to cross into Lebanon. On a clear day, you can see the Lebanese town of Rumaysh, a mere few miles away. Come down and go up to the roof of the church, overlooking the village at 2,460 feet above sea level. The church was spared direct bombardment in 1953, when the force that conquered Palestine shelled the village to prevent the return of its residents. For their part, the residents witnessed the bombardment from a nearby ridge that subsequently earned the name Tal al-Mabka, or the Weeping Hill. Tal al-Mabka. Stretch your arms and use your full strength to ring the big church bell that persists in the tower. Pull the rope hard and let the bell resound with the same human energy it receives from the inhabitants of the village who continue to visit it even after their expulsion. I must say, the writing of this article compared with just about all the other ones that I ever read to you is highly emotional, very flowery, and basically just plain damn good. New subheading, ruins. Very descriptive here, very emotionally laden. Ruins. As you listen to the echoes, observe the ruins of the demolished village, the walls of collapsed houses. Visualize the church who until... Again, visualize the people who until not long ago lived in these houses and prayed at that church. Recall their forced expulsion in 1948 of the expelled from Kafr Birim. Some became refugees in Lebanon. Others refugees as well as citizens in the new colonial state. Or, as the legal designation goes, internally displaced, quote unquote. This author is talking, of course, of refugees from villages wrested from them who withdrew to other parts of former Palestine, now Israel. So, internally replaced refers to Palestinian Arabs who are, technically speaking, citizens of Israel. Bizarrely flowery language within itself. Okay, going on with this article. Go further back in your journey in time. Do not stop in 1948. Zoom into the collapsed walls of the house next to the church. You should begin to hear the villagers' conversations and to visualize their lives. Enduring in the ruins. It should take you only a few minutes to return back more than 65 years in time and experience the village alive once again. This leap in time need not perplex you. No magic or technology is involved. This particular leap stands for the impossibility of complete destruction and expulsion, and hence for the possibility of return both in time and in space. New subheading. Time, now. And I see that James is back online now. Let me text him. I'm asking him to call me. New subheading and article. Time now. Avoid stretching your imagination. Not everything you hear and see is in the past tense. As you stand there, recognize the voices and the sights that are from the present time. Discern the dress code of the youth chatting, reading, and walking between the trees. Spot the lights on the Christmas tree in the corner of the square. Such decorations were uncommon prior to 1948. Look to the right. There is another group seated in the old school watching a movie. The movie is entitled Omar, which in January 2014 was nominated for an Oscar. Take note of others gathered in the square. They are assessing the court rulings in their case from December 2013 and April 2014. Rest assured, you are in time now. Prepare to experience the village before the Great Expulsion of 1948, coming to life again in time now, either in the same characters who once inhabited the village or in their children and grandchildren. Prepare to witness the return of the refugees, the undoing of their identity against the facts of 1948 and its aftermath. In August 2013, some of the refugees of Kafir Birim declared their return to their village. They resolved to transform. They resolved to transform return from a suspended horizon to a present practice, announcing that they were no longer refugees. They moved to live in the church and in the two-room school structure of the village, holding gatherings, parties, events, and concerts. Like others who have homes, they started receiving visitors. They became hosts again. Witness how decades of Zionist occupation and colonialization are set aside in favor of a life that persists despite them. But also prepare to observe how the powers of occupation and colonization attempt to fight back, reinstate the dominance of the colonial state, and renew the expulsion of 1948 under the guise of the, quote, evacuation orders, end quote, of 2013. New subheading, expulsion. Kafir Birim's Arab-Palestinian inhabitants, or Birimites, were expelled during the 1948 occupation of Palestine by Zionist forces. The Haganah militia occupied Kafir Birim on October 31 of that year, 48, during Operation Hiram, or Hiram, which resulted in the occupation of the Upper Galilee. The operation lasted 60 hours over October 29 to 31, and turned the Upper Galilee from being the mountainous area of northern Palestine that was to be designated as part of the Arab state according to the United Nations partition plan of 1947 to an area controlled by the new Jewish state. That's what leaps out of this article, this portion of the article, and strikes me that you know, it's hard enough, if not impossible, to convince many people to this day, some 66 years after the creation. What is it? 64, 5, 6, 64, 65 years. Yeah, 66 years after the 1948 nascent state of modern state of Israel was born. It's hard enough to get so many people to believe that the domination of the Jewish state that was initially designated by the UN to be a Jewish state happened largely by force of arms, but that the Jews and their militias, their Zionist militias, expanded well outside of the Jewish state. And what jumps out at me is how the Upper Galilee, I recall as being, was supposed to have been part of the Arab state, half of the UN partition, but the Zionists took it anyway. Well, anyway, that's what they're saying here. Back to the article. Years later, the village priest would recount in his memoir, Shahadati, or My Testimony, the events of the occupation and its aftermath. A three-day curfew was imposed on the village, and the residents were forced into the church as the military forces searched the houses. On November 7, the occupying authorities carried out a census. On November 7, the occupying authorities carried out a census, a population counting census and registered about 1,050 residents who, on November 13, were ordered to leave the village within 48 hours. Unwilling to abandon their home, they scattered in the woods. 7 children died in the November cold within the week. When the, quote, Minister of Minorities visited the nearby village of Jish, 2 Ibirimites conveyed to him the gravity of their situation. The following day, said minister arrived in Kafir Birim and announced the decision to transfer the inhabitants to Jish, promising them they could return home within 2 weeks when military operations near their northern border were slated to end. On November 19, the transfer was executed. And then parentheses here, having suffered bombing raids as of October 22, culminating in its occupation on October 29, in a cruel battle in which civilians and Arab prisoners of war were killed, Jish, too, had lost some of its inhabitants either to Lebanon or to the grave. Continuing here, Jish's emptied-out houses were not large or numerous enough to house all of Kafir Birim's refugees. About 200 of them found no shelter. The military governor ordered these people to seek a temporary housing in Rumaysh on the Lebanese side of the new border. Because the authorities promised the residents return to their village, they allowed 5 men to stay behind to secure the villagers' possessions. They, too, would soon be expelled, first by the settlers of what would become Kibbutz Biram, and later by an executive order confirming the settlers' action. The settlers moved in to the villagers' houses, leaving when they had set up a new settlement on the village's land. I'm just checking in with the Skype program here. There's no activity, even though... Well, once again, Mr. Vickery is offline. Poor guy. New subheading, citizen, refugee, subject. That's like citizen-refugee-subject. The occupying forces displaced the land from its people and claimed it as its new rulers, along with 30,000 to 40,000 other Palestinians. Birimites were displaced from their homes and villages, but remained inside the borders of the new state, along with the 150,000 Palestinians who were able to stay in their homes within the same borders. They became citizens. Consequently, they became citizen refugees, a fate that conventional political wisdom cannot comprehend, having divided the world's populations into citizens and refugees. Both identities, citizen and refugee, were the work of destructive displacement, namely, the displacement of the people and the displacement of the homeland. Because it captures only the internal layer of displacement, the category internally displaced fails to describe their status. And there is a third layer. Until 1966, military rule governed the Palestinians who remained in their homeland. Birimites, therefore, became citizens in a displaced homeland, refugees from a displaced village, and subjects of a military rule. Mind you now, they're talking about 1966, which is the year before the June War of 1967, when Israel launched an attack, not yet being penetrated, not yet having any of its territory proper penetrated by neighboring Arab armies, the armies of neighboring Arab nations. Israel launched this attack, ostensibly, supposedly, to assure its survival, being surrounded by all these oh-so-dastardly Arab countries. But in the process of launching the attack, Israel occupied, absorbed, and continued to hold on to Egypt-Sinai Peninsula right up to the eastern edge of the Suez Canal, the entire Sinai Peninsula, until it was returned a few years after negotiations directly with the Egyptian government began in 1979, and Sinai was returned to Egypt. That is another story. In the 67 war, Israel also occupied the balance of Palestine that they failed to occupy for one reason or another in 1948, completely ignoring the UN division between a Jewish state and an Arab state. They attacked what has come to be known by the common person as the West Bank. The Jews, many of them, prefer to call it Judea and Samaria, which are ancient references not pertinent to the present reality, except the artificial one that may be imposed by Jewish settlers. And, of course, in 67, Israel took the Gaza Strip, which was a possession of Egypt, but, of course, the southern end of which lies on the border with Sinai. Since Israel took all of the Sinai, they took all of the Gaza Strip, which itself was about a third or a fourth of the coastal or southwestern portion of historic Palestine that was supposed to remain in Arab hands, according to the UN's partition of Palestine, above the heads and without the primary participation of the Palestinians in that redesignation, that new drawing up of artificial borders. So you have in 67 Egypt Sinai and the balance of historic Palestine or British Mandate Palestine, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. The West Bank and East Jerusalem were in the hands of Jordan, the winning back of which allowed the Israelis to call it a liberation from the hands of the Jordanians. Let's not forget that sliver of land in the southwesternmost portion of Syria, the Golan Heights, also called the Golan Heights, which Israel still holds on to this day. So all of that land, minus Egypt Sinai, is still controlled by the Israelis. The West Bank, East Jerusalem, and southwestern Syria, controlled and patrolled by the Israeli military. And even though there are no Jewish settlers any longer in the Gaza Strip is still tightly closed at its borders, with no entry permitted by sea or by air, and very limited entry or exiting through the land gates of the Gaza Strip into Israel and into Egypt. Collusion by the current Egyptian government, whatever form that's currently in. So we have a de facto occupation. That is a legally defined occupation, according to the United Nations, by the way. When you have an outside neighboring belligerent force which places such strictures, restrictions, on the comings and goings of another area, hence an economic siege, and the creation of what is really an open-air prison, that is a de facto occupation. So, only accepting Egypt Sinai, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights of Syria, which still belong to Syria, or supposed to belong to Syria, and the Gaza Strip are all, in actuality or effectively, occupied by Israel. So, getting back to this article. That war happened in 67. This paragraph that I just read to you has to do with 1966, the year before. And they even then are talking about military rule in the Upper Galilee, what is supposed to be the Arab state area, Israeli military rule, governing the Palestinians who remained there in their homeland. Birimites therefore became citizens, and they displaced homeland, refugees from a displaced villages and subjects of military rule in 1966. So even before the June War of 67, there was all kinds of shenanigans going on in terms of the Israeli military oppressing and controlling and restricting the movements of Palestinians in their homeland. New subheading, the court. And again, I'm reading from an article brought to us by MERIP, Middle East Research and Information Project, published just this month, entitled A Guide for the Perplexed on the Return of the Refugees. And in this particular case, they're returning specifically to the return of refugees and their descendants to the village of Kafir Birim, which was taken from them by the Zionist Jewish militants and their subsequent army in 1948. Okay. It's an expulsion. Citizen refugee subject. Okay, new subheading titled The Court. As you listen to the group gathering in the square, notice the references to another village. Notice the references to another village called Ikrit. I-Q-R-I-T in English. Ikrit. Its refugees, too, had declared their return in September 2012. Situated about 12 miles west of Kafir Birim, Ikrit suffered a similar expulsion episode in 1948. Its residents, too, were promised they could return to their village within 2 weeks and subsequently denied return. Despite the fact that many villages suffered similar fates, Ikrit and Kafir Birim are the two names carved together in the Palestinian collective memory. The villagers from these places both initiated legal action in 1951. That was even before I was born, 1951, after their appeals to the government failed to secure their return. Both sets of complaints were ultimately denied return, though the ruling in Ikrit's case was much more favorable. Kafir Birim's priest would later recall the relevant legal documents in Arabic and Hebrew and reprint them as an appendix in his Shahadati, his memoir. Making it an indispensable legal archive covering the period until 1968. Okay. And David is still offline. I suspect the interview will, for a second time in a row, very sadly and much to my chagrin, will not be taking place today. I can't come close to expressing my adequate sorrow to those who, I just feel my face turning red now in both anger and embarrassment at my having announced the taking place of this interview beforehand. Let's just continue with the day, shall we? Birimites petitioned the High Court on August 31, 1951, against the Prime Minister, the Minister of Agriculture, the custodian of the absentee property, and the military governor. On October 8, 1951, the court issued an injunction demanding the respondent's response within 2 weeks. In his affidavit to the court, the deputy military governor for the Galilee stated that Kafir Birim was now a closed zone. Quote-unquote, closed zone. as declared on October 29, 1951, in accordance with the British colonial era emergency regulations of 1945. The refugee's lawyer counter-argued that the designation of the village as a security zone was issued 20 months after the expulsion. And since exit orders were not given at the time of expulsion, the, quote, closed zone order could not have legally justified that action. On November 30, the Army's Northern Command chief issued 215 exit orders targeting 545 Birnamites and delivered to 530 of them. Expulsion was thereby legalized retroactively. Military force, administration, and law all participated in the making of refugees. The court accepted the legalization of expulsion and further solidified the solidarity between legal and military force. The ruling stated that because the inhabitants were not forced to leave the village in November 1948, but left it in response to the request of the Army and in order to facilitate Army operations, and because exit orders were issued against the Birnamites, in the meantime, they could not be allowed to return. Indeed, no military force was deployed in the expulsion of the Birnamites. The power displacing them consisted in the deceptive promise of a military force, the demanding words of an institution of organized violence that had already brought bloody destruction in other places. The language of consent that the court juxtaposed so radically to force. The language of consent that the court juxtaposed so radically to force, as if one could not be forced to consent or consent to force, or as if expulsion always had to follow a bloody battle, allowed the court to distance itself from the events of expulsion. The legal category, consent, situated expulsion in a domain that invited no judicial review. Consent in modern legal systems belongs to that domain of unobjectionable human action that invites no legal intervention. I know, folks, I'm starting to lose my ability to wrap myself behind this person's words, too. We're about halfway through it. Let's just plow on through here. Continuing with the article. By deploying this legal category, the court wished such a human action into existence so that the law could recuse itself. Expulsion itself became something that presented no problem. Bombardment could therefore follow. In September 1953, the Israeli army bombarded the village from the air and the ground, destroying most of it, save the church and the cemetery. New subheading, The Return Drive. That court ruling sealed the fate of Birnamites as no different from that of other Palestinian refugees inside and outside their homeland. Until the decision, Birnamites thought that their expulsion would be temporary. In February 1949, some of them went to the village to outfit their houses against the rain. Little did they know that in less than 2 years, the entire village would be destroyed. In response, the army arrested around 65 of them and expelled them to the West Bank, outside of Israel proper. They became refugees again in a camp near Nablus. When the families and friends of these double refugees learned of their fate, they helped them return to Jish through Syria and Lebanon. In 1972, the government abolished the regulation of, quote, security zones all over the country. If their village was no longer legally inaccessible, Birnamites thought they should be able to return. or so they hoped as they initiated several political campaigns. Their hope proved, once again, to be naive as the government rejected their appeal. To protest, a number of Biramites returned to the village and went on a hunger strike, or what they called a fast. A few days later, they terminated the fast but stayed in the village. Their case, together with that of Ikrit, gained significant visibility in the foreign and local press in both Hebrew and Arabic. On December 1972, in an order based on the Mandate-era emergency regulations of 1945, the Northern Command Chief declared Kafir Birim, as well as Ikrit, a closed zone, allowing day visits only, as well as use of the church. The returning refugees would ultimately be evacuated by force, but they continued to return during the day. In the 1990s, they started holding annual summer camps in the destroyed village, actualizing day and night return for a period of 10 days. The activism in the 1970s etched Kafir Birim and Ikrit as a pair in the Palestinian political collective consciousness. Additionally, right to left, Zionist politicians began to promise solutions. Some even advanced particular policy recommendations, none of which were implemented. The 1949 return was perhaps no real return. The villagers understood themselves to have been only temporarily displaced. The return of 1972 was an act of protest. The refugees demanded that they be granted the right to return. But the returning refugees you are witnessing now, the returnees of 2013, no longer demand recognition of their right. Instead, they practice it. So let me start that sentence again with the proper inflections. But the returning refugees you are witnessing now, the returnees of 2013, no longer demand recognition of their right. Instead, they practice it. This time, every day and every night. Birimites followed in the footsteps of Ikrit's refugees, who had declared their return a year earlier in September 2012. Call it a Palestinian unilateral return. And there is a full-color picture of some elderly gentlemen in what must be one of the two remaining buildings, I would guess the church, or lower levels of the church, sitting and standing at a long wooden table with the television set in the background. A Camp Line brand state-of-the-art pop-up camping tent erected, but still inside this church basement here. And they're talking, enjoying their unilateral return. Okay. New subheading of article, Palestinian Time. How to explain this persisting return? How to interpret this defiance of the movement of time? At issue is an unbroken relationship that sums up and summons all past connections, memories, and lived experiences leading up to the present. It is as if decades of displacement since the Great Expulsion of 1948 belonged to a time, call it Zionist colonial time, that had no effects on the temporality of the relationship between the village and its inhabitants, call it Palestinian time. While the former, Zionist time, stretches itself forward and expands into future decades, attempting to occupy Palestinian life, land, and the future of the relationship between the two, the latter, Palestinian time, is the time that always remains. That is to say, the time that never passes, never progresses. never succumbs to the time of relentless expansion, but to the contrary, keeps it at bay. Perhaps this is the way to understand how the land could be occupied. The people displaced, the village destroyed, the agricultural land exploited by settlers, and the villagers leading new lives elsewhere, and yet how the same material that once cemented the village to its people continues to cement it now. Something magnificent has escaped occupation and colonization, something that may only be understood once it is recognized that the time of the occupied and the time of the occupier do not share the same calendar. This unshared calendar signifies the incompleteness of the colonization of Palestine. Rescuing my throat here, folks. Don't go away. Just checking back to see what's happening with David. Yeah, it does indeed look as though my contact in Morocco, Mr. David Victory, has given up. Perhaps has gone to bed. Perhaps not. He appears to be a late-night person. God bless him. But, David, if you're listening, yeah, I'll get in touch with you again. Looks like we're going to have to do this interview on real time on my home PC, which seems to be a better deal than what we got going here. Then again, we will have to wait until your microphone problem is taken care of. The people at Santa Cruz Progressive's email list, Free Gaza Discussions list on Google, the free radio list, and all my friends and enemies, all of whom received, once again, my notification that this interview would take place, you have permission to shoot me. Just shoot me, okay? Another magnificent glitch to put on my radio career resume. Oh, boy. Don't you just love free radio, folks? Live radio. You know, live. This unshareable calendar signifies the incompleteness of the colonization of Palestine. New subheading. The no longer refugee. While their return has not produced new political realities that cannot be undone by state violence, the political significance of the return of the Biramites should be sought not in the political solution they achieve, but in the political practice they introduce. When they first returned to their village, the refugees of Irkut, the refugees of Ikrit, announced on their Facebook page, quote, "We are no longer refugees. We have returned," end quote, while Biramites said, "I declare my return." What does the utterance, "We are no longer refugees," do? What is the significance of declaring unilateral return? The meaning and efficacy of this utterance must be sought in the context of its deployment. This context is a space reconfigured through occupation, ethnic cleansing, and significantly, the fragmentation of the Palestinian people into different population groups. Fragmentation is the result of the deployment of legal and military force, producing discrete population groups. Palestinian citizens in Israel, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and Palestinian refugees. Significantly, these groups belong to and identify with different legal regimes, and in turn claim these legal identifications as the basis of struggles, as if these struggles do not intersect. Accordingly, the struggle of Palestinian citizens proceeds by claiming equal citizenship rights as well as, in some cases, national minority rights. The horizon for Palestinian subjects living under occupation is to establish a sovereign, not occupied state. And refugees claim the right to return. It follows that the identities that the military and legal force engendered for the Palestinians have become the grounds for their discrete struggles against it. What is unchallenged is the making of these separate identities. Further, by dividing the Palestinian people into diverse population groups, allocating to them different legal identities and possible horizons, fragmentation makes difficult a unifying political practice and struggle, presenting Palestinians instead with discrete solutions that unwittingly reproduce fragmentation. And behind all that very academically worded mumbo-jumbo, I think within that lies the real crux of this article, namely that Israel has succeeded in implementing that age-old strategy of divide and conquer. Initially, in the early days, 1947, 48, 49, the early 50s, just force your way into a situation, change the facts on the ground, create a new reality, and force the dispossessed, the innocent, the usually unarmed in these kinds of conflicts, unarmed to begin with, into a new reality where they are out of reach of one another and they fall into new categories. I'm starting to sound like the author of this article. Divide and conquer, folks. Once you've made the divisions and you start readministering things to your liking, those who fell prey, the original inhabitants who fell prey to the new order, are out of arm's reach with one another. And so they cannot resist, they cannot reoccupy their old homes, their ancestral lands, and they have no power. That's what I have to say about that. Let's continue with the article. This person just goes on, I think, to flesh out what I was just saying. This fragmented depiction does not map out on the reality of the Palestinian people. On the most basic level, these groups are not so distinct. Each group includes refugees, that is, Palestinians who have been expelled from their homes, cities, and villages. Equally significant is the unifying experience of displacement among all Palestinians. Unifying experience. Once Palestine itself is occupied, those who were expelled were displaced in the legal sense. But for both those who remained and those who were expelled, the homeland itself was displaced. Their movement and living within it was and continues to be restricted. Not a single Palestinian today has access to all of Palestine. What unites all Palestinians, then, are their displacement from their homes and the displacement of their homeland. Against the fragmented depiction of the Palestinians, we may therefore say that in some sense all Palestinians are refugees, or that the constitutive political experience of all Palestinians is that of displacement. Returning to the utterance, we are no longer refugees. While it belongs to the same space of legal plurality as rule, it undoes temporarily the identity of the refugee and the experience of displacement. The declaration of return does not undo the effect of legal, bureaucratic, and military ethnic cleansing of Palestine. It does not actualize full return for the entirety of the Palestinian people. Rather, it commences from the grounds of the unifying experience that of displacement and refuge and proceeds to undo it, initiating a political struggle from outside the structure of fragmented identities. In this utterance, we are no longer refugees. What was once only a solution is now also a means. What was once a political demand is now also a practice. The identity of the refugee is both mobilized and set aside in the struggle and political practice of return. The utterance, "I am no longer a refugee," registers a past of refuge, but pulls the future promise of return into the present, bridging the gap between the end and the means. The no longer refugee is a new political identity that intentionally refuses the identities of rule while grounding itself in and against the common experience of displacement. New subheading, evacuation order. The 2013 return unfolded outside the confines of the law, mainly because petitioning the High Court again probably would have resulted in a precedent that would have condemned Birimites to a future as refugees. Soon afterward, however, the law caught up with them. On August 21, 2013, a green patrol inspector from the Nature and Natural Parks Protection Authority toured the area and reportedly found tents, an electric generator, and new water faucets. He also noticed newly planted trees, flowers, and vegetables, in addition to a pile of stones behind the church that was not there before. The inspector recorded all these activities, including those of cultivating nature, as constituting a trespass in violation of the status quo as it had existed for many years. He also filed a complaint with the police. In future inspections, the police, he and his colleagues observed additional new tents, plants, and restrooms. Consequently, on September 16, 2013, the Israel Land Authority, the ILA, the government agency charged with managing Kafir Birim's land after its occupation in 1948 and consequent seizure by the state, issued an evacuation order against Birimites, arguing that they had trespassed on and seized the land of Kafir Birim. Its original occupants declares the State of Israel had seized their land back, but they probably didn't use the word back. New subheading, lawsuit. In response, one Birimite, acting as a plaintiff, filed a lawsuit demanding the cancellation of this order as well as a temporary hold on execution of the evacuation order until a decision is reached in the lawsuit. His lawyer argued that Birimites, the holders of historical rights to the land, have been using and demonstrating ownership of the land since the early 1970s. Accordingly, the evacuation order was issued too late and was therefore invalid. Over the past 45 years, the villagers renovated the church, prayed in it, possessed it, and invested hundreds of thousands of shekels, the Israeli coin of the realm, monetary unit, in its maintenance. All the new structures that the inspector notes were built years ago, the only new addition being the 43-square-foot garden. A procedural argument aiming to invalidate the order on grounds of delay asserted that the villagers have been the possessors of their village for at least 40 years, or in other words, that they have already accomplished their return. The repossession of the village is now a long-standing reality. The lawsuit also narrates the long history of struggle to return since 1948 in the courts, in the parliament, and in other civil society settings. Both the government promises and their retractions are recounted in order to establish that the association with the land, as well as the quest to return, not only never ceased to be, but were also never fully and completely denied by the state. The petition mobilizes. Government promises to assert that the expulsion is reversible, that return is tangible, and that Kafir Birim's fate is not yet sealed. The Land Authority, the respondent, counter-argued that the Development Authority, not any collective of Biramites, owns Kafir Birim. That according to the Land Law of 1969, state ownership records constitute indisputable evidence that said authority and not the villagers have ownership rights over this land. That other claims to historic rights and past events are irrelevant and cannot be considered on a par with the state-generated records. In the presence of a state that arrogates to itself ownership rights, generates its own ownership records, and passes laws that make these records the only valid proof of ownership, Biramites are turned into trespassers on their own land. The Land Authority, too, mobilized a number of legal decisions to argue that the Biramite status is resolved. On December 22, 2013, the Magistrate Court issued an injunction to stop the execution of the evacuation order until a final decision is reached in the lawsuit. The court reasoned that while the plaintiff does not have ownership rights, he proved that Biramites have had a link or an association with the land for many decades. Having proved the existence of such a historical association, the Land Authority could not evacuate the villagers with an administrative order. Such was the legal rule as established by the High Court in other cases of trespass, in cases in which quote-unquote trespassers have some affinity with the land, they can only be evacuated by judicial, not administrative order. The result, no evacuation will be concluded before the conclusion of the lawsuit. New subheading, not historical rights. The cement that binds Biramite's fate to the land does not consist of state records of ownership generated after the occupation of their village, but is constituted by decades of both habitation and struggle. What seals the villagers' fate as, quote, no longer refugees, end quote, is not a paper that states can either generate or destroy, but a life that cannot be recorded through the prism of ownership or coded by the law. Meanwhile, colonial law desires precisely the opposite, to be pervasive everywhere and to colonize all dissenting forms of life. The Land Authority appealed to the District Court. The District Court judge accepted the appeal. He ruled that Birimites have no rights to the land. The historical rights they had were no longer valid. He concluded, any relationship between the historical ownership rights and the contemporary right to hold the land by those who used to be the inhabitants of Ikrit and Kafir Birim has been severed. The only right they have is to compensation. Historical rights are irrelevant. And yet the rights that Biramites, in effect, are claiming are not merely historical. They are not rights that stem from a past that ceased to be. They are claims that stem from their present relationship with Kafir Birim, from their form of life. Even as these claims translate into a political practice that summons and sums up the past in the present, this past is not, quote, historical, in the sense that it is a foreign and detached period in history. At issue is a relationship to the land that defies the movement of history forward, a movement that is the condition of possibility of the, quote, historical right. The conceptualization of these rights can only be relevant to the calendar of the colonizer-occupier, the calendar of progressive history. What classifies Biramites as no longer refugees is not a historical right to the land weakened with the movement of history, but a life and a bond that persists despite the movement of colonial time. Oh, what a web we weave. Don't put too much significance on that thing that I just said. Okay, here's the last subheading for the article. Lubia. Biramites submitted an appeal to the High Court. Its fate will be decided soon. But this story of return did not start with the law, and therefore should not end with the law. As you stand on the roof of the church on May 6, 2014... That date hasn't even happened yet. May 6, 2014, observe the no longer refugees joining, quote, the march of return to another destroyed and depopulated village. Lubia, a Palestinian village located 6 miles west of Tiberias. Lubia was occupied, depopulated, and destroyed in 1948. Behold the marchers as they reverse the unifying experience of displacement, as they undo identities of colonial rule, and as they persevere in being no longer refugees. Very long article, very in-depth scholarly piece of work, or the reader presumes that a lot of research had gone into it. Certainly a vivid example of storytelling with a lot of legalities involved. This from MIRIP, Middle East Research and Information Project, published April 2014, A Guide for the Perplexed on the Return of the Refugees. Towards the end there, when I pronounce my little expression, oh, what a tangled web we weave, I wasn't talking about lies. I was talking about a corner that one can possibly back themselves into. This article, of course, by Samira Esmir, begins with a rather brave... A vivid account of a brave return, physical return, of still living individuals to their ancestral lands and their children and great and great great grandchildren accompanying them. That was taken a couple of generations ago, but still within the lifetime of many who are still, in fact, living today. Interestingly, though, I found myself, and it almost sounds as though I'm belying my motivations for doing this program, but I found myself reading arguments that the Palestinians, native indigenous Palestinians, are making for unrefugizing themselves and making themselves indigenous again. Isn't this what the Jews have been saying? The Zionist Jews who created Israel, starting many decades before, who began to remake their national homeland several decades before they pronounced a state in 1948. Could they not use these same arguments to justify ethnic cleansing and expulsion of native Arabs because their great, 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 etc., etc., parents before them once occupied the land when it was an empire well over 2,000 years ago? I'm sure they will tell you this is the case. But, as I see it, the most critical difference is we're not talking about ancient history in terms of the Palestinians who survived the killings and expulsions of 1948 and of 1967 and all the ones before and since. Those who are still alive will talk about their ancestral lands, but most importantly, the fact that this is where they are from in the course of their immediate lives. This alone justifies repatriation to their lands and compensation, money or otherwise, as far as I'm concerned, compensation from the Israeli state, the Zionist entity. And that this could and should take place today. We're talking about people who can remember Kafir Birim, Ikrit, and Lubia, and the hundreds and thousands of other places that are still in the memories and the pictures mentioned in the memoirs and journals of those both alive and now dead. Palestine is still alive. Palestinians are still alive. And yet Israel is slowly waiting for them to just disappear, to finally die off altogether. And then it won't be an issue anymore, will it, folks? Okay, my friends, it's 4:43 p.m. We have 12 official minutes left of Mideast Migraines to go. This is Mideast Migraines, brought to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, 101.3 on your FM dial, in the city of Santa Cruz, California. We are also broadcasting on our internet radio service at freakradio.org. Don't forget to click on the red oval the next time you're on it. Okay. Where is my guy for the Publix? Well, that was a longie. Minutes to go. Can I begin to cover this? Huffington Post, in the religion category. Is it necessarily religion? In the U.S. edition of HuffPost, interfaith group slams film scheduled to be shown at the new 9/11 Museum over the portrayal of Islam by Karen Matthews last Thursday, April 24th. Again, this is on the HuffPost internet page. New York Associated Press. A film that will be shown at the National September 11 Memorial Museum when it opens next month unfairly links Islam and terrorism, clergy members said in letters demanding it be changed. The Rise of Al-Qaeda, a brief documentary narrated by NBC anchor Brian Williams, shows the growth of international terrorist groups in the recent years. Okay. Shows the growth of international terrorist groups in the years leading up to the 2001 attacks in New York and Washington. The film has not been publicly released, but museum officials have screened it for groups, including an interfaith clergy advisory panel. Members of the clergy group sent a letter to museum officials this week asking that the film be re-edited to make it clear that not all Muslims support the terrorists who destroyed the World Trade Center. Quote, we continue to posit that the video may very well leave viewers with the impression that all Muslims bear some collective guilt or responsibility for the actions of Al-Qaeda, or even misinterpret its content to justify bigotry or even violence toward Muslims or those perceived to be Muslim, for example, Sikhs, you know, the guys with the wraparound headgear. End quote. Except that last remark about headgear. The clergy members wrote, the signers included Peter G. Gudaitis, a chief executive of New York Disaster Interfaith Services, and the Reverend Chloe Breyer, executive director of the Interfaith Center of New York. Officials at the September 11 Museum, which opens May 21st at the Trade Center site, said the film doesn't suggest that all Muslims are terrorists. Quote, our number one standard is, are we objectively telling the story of what happened? And we feel like we've satisfied that, the museum's executive director, Joe Daniels, said Thursday. He said museum officials, quote, stand by the scholarship that underlies the creation of this video. An imam, Sheikh Mustafa Elazabawi of the Masjid Manhattan Mosque, resigned from the museum's advisory panel last month to protest the film. He said in a separate letter to the museum's director that the film, and I quote, in its present state would greatly offend our local Muslim believers as well as any foreign Muslim visitor to the museum, end quote. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee called concerns expressed about the documentary, quote, extremely worrisome. Ibrahim Hooper, a spokesman for the Council on American Islamic Relations, said museum officials should not reinforce negative stereotypes of Muslims as terrorists. Generations of visitors to this facility will be influenced by the contents of the displays and the presentations, Hooper said. It's going to be very important how Islam and the American Muslim community are portrayed. There are no comments on this entry yet on the old HuffPost. In the 5 or 6 minutes remaining, let's see if we can cite some other opinions on this matter. That was from HuffPost. We are now referring to CNN, CNN's internet website. The Belief Blog. Both of these articles appear in the religious sections of the respective publishers, first HuffPost and now the Cable News Network. Does 9/11 Museum slander Muslims? CNN. Interfaith leaders object to a film slated to be part of an exhibit in the National September 11 Memorial Museum. The Rise of Al-Qaeda, narrated by NBC's Brian Williams, is supposed to provide a brief history of the terrorist group. Here are the opening lines. Quote, this program describes the emergence of the terrorist organization that carried out the 9/11 attacks. It concentrates on a period of roughly 15 years, beginning with Al-Qaeda's founding during the Soviet-Afghan War and concluding with its rationale and planning for the attacks of 2001. The program tracks Al-Qaeda's embrace of violence and the decision of its leadership to commit mass murder at the dawn of the 21st century. End quote. But faith leaders say the film does not draw a sharp enough distinction between Al-Qaeda and Muslims in general. Now, I clicked on the link to get the full story. And here it is. Continuing. Quote, the facts are presented in a context that is not nuanced enough for the audience, which is expecting to see the movie, says Reverend Ruth Yoder Wenger of New York Disaster Interfaith Services. I'll say that again. The facts are presented in a context that is not nuanced enough for the audience expecting to see the movie, says Reverend Yoder Wenger. Clearly, she seems to have a pretty solid idea of the intellectual caliber of the people expecting to see the movie, which is to say the common American or the common visitor. Continuing with the article, quote, we're convinced that the way this story is told equates Muslims in general with Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group, and that people coming away from viewing the video will make that same association in their minds, says Wagner. Not all Muslims are terrorists, but the ones that carried out the 9/11 attacks were Muslim extremists. Quote, we'd prefer people talk about an Al-Qaeda extremism or Islamic extremism, but simply using Muslim and Islam every time you mention Al-Qaeda or terrorist just draws a constant association between the two faith communities, says Peter B. Gudatis. Also with New York Disaster Interfaith Services. Incidentally, there's a link here to the organization's official letter to the museum here. I will not go through with that. Instead, I'll just continue with the article. Instead of being narrated by Williams, some of the translations in the film are voiced over in broken English by someone with a heavy Middle Eastern accent, a move the interfaith group calls sensationalists. When any one faith community or people is vilified in history, we try to make them different, says Gudatis. It just felt to us unnecessary and a bit sensationalist. In March, the only imam who was part of the interfaith advisory group to the museum resigned over the film, the New York Times reports. Quote, unsophisticated visitors who do not understand the difference between Al-Qaeda and Muslims may come away with a prejudiced view of Islam, leading to antagonism and even confrontation toward Muslim believers near the site. Sheikh Mustafa Al-Zabawi said in a letter to the museum's director, evidently Mr. Al-Zabawi is worried that confrontations may crop up between people who just saw the film at the museum and may perhaps run into a Muslim or even head over towards the location of the Islamic Center a few blocks from the site of the attack. That's my take on it. The museum should, quote, reshape the story to draw attention to the positive impact of Muslims, both in response to September 11, the vital work that was done across faith lines there, and also just putting it into a broader context, end quote, says Wagner. Quote, a major part of preserving the history of September 11 is to show who is responsible for the monstrous attack on America that led to the deaths of thousands of innocent people of various ethnicities and religious beliefs, end quote, a spokesman for the museum told CNN in an email. The museum declined CNN's request to see the video. Quote, this brief film, within the context of surrounding exhibits, focuses on the roots of Al-Qaeda with the express purpose of helping visitors understand who perpetrated the 9/11 terrorist attacks. It does not purport to be a film about Islam or in any way marginalize that Muslims are terrorists, the spokesman wrote. A spokesperson from Williams, Brian Williams, the NBC anchor who narrates the film, said, the NBC, National Broadcasting Corporation anchor, quote, did not take the request to narrate this film lightly, and after receiving a script from the museum, asked two leading experts to carefully review the wording. He, Williams, was not involved in the editing of the film and has not yet seen a final version, end quote. The National September 11 Memorial Museum will open to the general public on May 21st. It's 4:56 in the afternoon, April 28th, 2014. The show is over. Any further information about the once again canceled, due to technical difficulties, interview with David James Vickery will proceed from my mouth and become available to you forthwith, hopefully in the next couple of weeks. For the 99th time, I do apologize for the letdown. I'll be here next Monday at 3 in the afternoon, and of course, starting to finish, the beginning of the end of Max Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, his book, will take place at 11 p.m. this Saturday. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, April 24th, 2014. Israeli tanks invade parts of the Gaza Strip while troops kidnap 11 civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Today is Monday, April 20.
A number of armored Israeli military vehicles invaded Palestinian farmlands east of Al-Karara town, northwest of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Tanks uprooted and bulldozed the invading lands and opened fire at nearby homes. Local sources reported that 5 Israeli tanks and 2 armored bulldozers advanced more than 200 meters into the farmlands and bulldozed them. Vehicles left the nearby Kusafim military base across the border fence and fired rounds of live ammunition at homes and structures in the area. Israeli military helicopters were also seen flying over the area while the army invading it. Also in Gaza, Israeli Navy opened fire at fishermen off the coast of the northern coastal enclave. The Israeli army claimed that the fishermen were out of the designated area for them. As part of the Oslo Accords, Palestinians are allowed to fish in 20 nautical miles of coast. However, Israeli Navy forces imposed a 3 nautical miles limit on Palestinian fishing boats. Elsewhere, 11 Palestinian civilians were kidnapped by Israeli troops during dawn and morning invasions targeting West Bank communities. Israeli soldiers invaded their Samad village near the southern West Bank city of Hebron and kidnapped 8 Palestinians. 2 more Palestinians from Annabi Saleh near the central West Bank city of Ramallah and 1 near Tubas in northern West Bank. Local sources reported that soldiers assaulted the 2 kidnapped young men from Annabi Saleh and fired concussion grenades at their homes. Soldiers also attacked family members, inflicting various injuries. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, April 24th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
Today is Monday, April 28th, 2014, and you're listening to the World Socialist website. The Ukraine Crisis and the Political Lies of the Media by Alex Lantier. As the Obama administration and its allies in Europe escalate their threats against Russia over the crisis in Ukraine, the American media plays its assigned role as propaganda mouthpiece. Not a single critical voice can be found within the so-called mainstream media. The newspapers and television news programs are filled with lies, anti-Russian propaganda, and preparing for the possibility that the crisis escalates out of control. Apologetics for war. The New York Times, the so-called newspaper of record, sets the general tone for the media as a whole. The Times boasts of having 12 reporters in Ukraine, yet it provides no serious reporting on what is happening. This is all the more significant, given the extraordinary implications of a major conflict between the United States and Russia that could quickly evolve into the first war between nuclear powers in world history. Over the past 2 weeks, the Times has been caught in a series of fabrications. Last week, it ran a front-page lead story replete with photographs handed to it by the State Department and the U.S.-backed Ukrainian government, purporting to show that Russian special forces are directing the protests in eastern Ukraine. The Times report was quickly exposed as a fraud, including by the WSWS. It took only a quick search on the internet to expose the so-called evidence as either doctored or fabricated. Subsequent acknowledgments of the so-called controversy over the photographs, exercises in damage control and cover-up, have been buried on the newspaper's inside pages. Far from being chastened by these exposures,